When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting the Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting the Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Dr. Sonia Banks. Dr. Banks is a clinical psychologist and behavioral health strategist who uses behavioral play to change attitudes and introduce people to their possible selves. She has been a featured therapist in several articles published in Essence magazine and contributed to articles for the American Journal of Public Health, and she's appeared on NBC, ABC, and Cox Radio. She has co-authored a new book with Dr. Linda Anderson and Dr. Michelle Owens. It's called Silent Agreements, How to Free Your Relationships of Unspoken Expectations. Dr. Banks, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
I read your book last week, and it was so interesting to then find myself in a number of conversations, both at home and at work, where it became abundantly clear that the misunderstandings that were happening were not because we disagreed on the matter at hand, but because we hadn't spoken aloud our actual feelings, intent, and beliefs. And this is something that is happening a lot more than most people recognize, correct?
That is absolutely true. You know, we noticed this in our clinical practices, the three psychologists that gathered about 18 years ago as a study group to look at this phenomenon, because we noticed that people kept bringing these expectations and intentions, and they hadn't said a word out loud to the other person that they had them about. And so, yes, these little things are undercurrents in our lives, networks, if you will, that lapse, that go over and over and over again and stack, I always say, like pancakes in our lives. So it is a big secret that we're trying to uncover so people have a better understanding of why these things occur and why they stay silent.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because I think it's very interesting in terms of how does this happen? Why do we have silent agreements with ourselves? And you write in the book, quote, "What's the big lesson you learned? That telling people how you really feel is bad." And that's something that is really kind of drummed into us as even kids and in school and elsewhere, right?
Absolutely. As children, we always get the double message. We use the scenario with the neighbor. You have a neighbor as a child, you're 3 years old, 4 years old, and every time the neighbor and your mom meet on the street or in the grocery store, it's hugs and kisses, and the neighbor's asking about you, and mom looks delighted. Until that day, the neighbor rings the doorbell, and unannounced, your mother seems concerned or your father seems upset and puts the finger in front of your lips. And now you get a totally different message, hide from the friendly neighbor. And you're perplexed, right? So we start to realize that there are two ways that we're supposed to approach an event or an experience, and don't run into that neighbor the next day as the child. And you say, "Oh, Mrs. Smith, we heard the doorbell, but mom told me to shush and hide." Oh my God, you get the look from heck, right?
Yeah.
And that's how you start to learn that you can't express what you think or feel or what you even believe is under play in an experience, because you can get in trouble and you can get silent.
So one of the things we know about improvisation in our many years at Second City, teaching the work, is that the one thing, the major thing that undermines successful improvisations between people is fear, when people are in their fear brain. And that's kind of the same thing here, right?
That's right. You named it. It literally starts with this this sense of, am I going to get in trouble if I tell somebody what I think? And it's so automatic. It's like you have this conscious understanding that that's what you're supposed to do, right? Because you're told, tell the truth, articulate what you feel, stand up for your point of view. But yet when you get in the workplace, you sit around a conference table, the first person who tells the boss the truth ends up in a position where they may or may not be in line for that promotion. Mm-hmm. Or in a marital or couple situation, you can't say everything you think or feel because you don't want to undermine the person's sense of confidence and psychological safety in the relationship. So every time you're balancing fear with the sense of faith that you believe the relationship currency is enough for you to go out on that limb and take a chance saying something you think might be true for both of you, or at least for one of you.
And we're not just not saying stuff. There's other things that we do that play in this category. You talk about diversion. You talk about multi-layering. Talk to us about how this also plays out in other ways.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it so complicated, right? Because sometimes you absolutely know there's an approach you need to take. My favorite one is it's Thanksgiving, and we've been doing this way of approaching our kitchen as a couple where you wash the dishes and I cook. Well, now it's Thanksgiving and 40 people are coming.
Yeah.
So we don't actually have a conversation about it. It's assumed we're both going to help each other, but it's never articulated. Now, I don't want to have that conversation with you, right? Because mm-hmm. I know where it's going to end up. You want to watch the game, or, you know, somebody asked you to pick them up at the bus station and you're doing all of this traveling. So I delay it. Or I use a diversion. Mm-hmm. Oh, I won't be in the house when he's in the house. Or I will stay away from the kitchen. Or when we bring up, hey, how's the day going to go? We go, oh, it's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. We're diverting our attention away from having the narrative that's going to actually insist and force us to get into some real truth, because somebody's going to get put out. Someone's going to have more work to do, and someone may have to face a belief or an intention that they didn't want to. So that diversion happens. Then the other diversion that we don't even know it is because, you know, silent agreements, if they're going really well, you don't even know you're in them. You don't know you're in them until there's a problem.
Right.
So sometimes they're going really well and you just divert yourself. You know, I stack the dishes in the dishwasher and I know you come out and you change them and put them the way you want. And we've been doing this for like 10 years. We don't actually need to say anything. I just always find that it's best if I leave the kitchen when you're rearranging my dishes. And you actually appreciate the fact that I don't criticize the fact that you're rearranging the dishes in the dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blended alignment of our silent agreements. It's going swimmingly well, and we divert each other so we don't actually need to have the conversation.
Okay, so that's the problem. And you also talk about how you can change this. And when I started to read this chapter, we have a partnership at the University of Chicago called the Second Science Project, where we study behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. So we get to work with these wonderful scholars. And one of the first things that we worked on was in improvisation, we have this yes and exercise, which gets to an abundant amount of ideas. And their question for us was sort of like, yeah, but what happens when it's a really thorny thing that people don't agree on? And we kind of invented this new idea for the exercise called Thank You Because. But the essence of it is that if you can show real gratitude for the person with whom you might disagree, you might have a conflict, and they show gratitude back to you, you have an opportunity to actually stay inside this difficult conversation. And you talk about trust and respect being an essential part of how you can upend or disrupt these silent agreements.
Absolutely. We're both in the same part of the Venn diagram overlapping there. You nailed it. You really do have to use what I always call the relationship currency, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thank you because, the trust that the relationship is built on more than where we see things in common and where we see things divergently. The relationship is built on a fundamental way of making meaning that we've both decided works for us, and so we trust each other. We haven't had any surprise that has really made us feel that we were fully disrespected or disregarded. And because of that, each day in any relationship between people or organisms, organizations, teams, groups. We keep trusting every day because we haven't had the experience to tell us not to. And I think when you recognize the positivity and the huge, amazing abundance in that gift that we keep giving each other and we call the relationship currency, we actually can start to go into these silent agreements with a whole different way. You know, one of the ways one of my co-authors, Michelle Owens, refers to this is the misalignment of understanding. Mm. And when you have that gratitude and when you're looking at life in terms of the abundance, you offer the alignment as a carrot, as a branch to walk out on, because you know that fundamentally, most of the time, there are enough alignments for you all to be able to complete a joint thought, you know? And so we're always trying to get you to massage it, which is what, you know, improvisation does, right?
Yeah.
Get you to massage what the creative element is to give you more of a buffer and more of a opportunity to seize that connection, you know, the one that makes you smile and laugh and want to play through it instead of, you know, retracting and looking for or identifying a reason to abandon the narrative in the conversation.
Yeah, it's really hard. I think that's a thing that we also have to acknowledge, which is you can have the biggest brain in the world and you can be a very warm-hearted person and still to maintain a position of gratitude throughout a day and all these different interactions with people is really, really hard. And so I think that, you know, and we're not... We don't have a place to practice this, right? That's one of the great problems we have, especially, you know, as people aren't going to church as much, especially in urban areas, and they don't have they're more isolated and they're behind their devices. That we don't have as much practice in that sort of human to human work it out together. And you talk about in this chapter around reframing, which I think is so important, that it really requires you to sort of, you know, reframe both your own, like how you're thinking about things and how you believe things, and also how you're looking at this person across from you.
Absolutely. You know, often we all know that you're really often, more often than we try to admit, talking to parts of yourself, right, in the other person. Mm-hmm. And that's why you get so intently, whatever, angry or happy, whatever the emotion is, because you're gravitating to the trigger or the part in that person that keeps erupting or disrupting your belief system. And you want them to stop it. You're like, quiet, stop being that person.
Yeah.
So I can exercise my right to project how I feel about it onto you. Okay.
Right.
You're disrupting it. So what we're always trying to do when our mind says, wait a minute, hold your gains, you know, hold your ground. You're trying to make your heart lead your mind. And many practitioners, and you said it so perfectly well, spend at least 20, 30 minutes in the beginning of the day because it's like a shower. We have to move ourselves into that place of where we want to be throughout the day and recognize, is this how I want to show up? And what is it in this conversation that really matters to me?
Mm.
And often I will stop in the middle of something where I feel like I really have to make that one extra point because you didn't hear me, and say to myself, say out loud, wait a minute, I didn't hear me. And what it does is it forces me to realize the person I'm really trying to talk to is the part of myself that I'm holding you accountable to. So I think in order to stay in this space, we have to endear and endure these practices in the morning, in the afternoon, because we're human. So, you know, all day long, these traumas, these isolated fears, these multi-layered, you know, issues and old relationship ghosts rear their heads and ask us to bring them in the room with us. And so we're having these conversations with 12 different ghosts instead of actually the person in front of us. And when you get really quiet and say, what do I really like about this person?
Mm-hmm.
And 9 times out of 10, there's something that has you in the room. It could be the color of their jeans. It could be the fact they're still holding space. If you witness to that, regardless of whether it has anything to do with what you're talking about, you can shift into the conversation about what I really like about you is, And that moves you out of that space and head. The other thing I do, which I know you guys do, is I force people to do jumping jacks.
Yeah.
I ask couples to argue naked. You know, anything to make sure that you are mindful of the fact that the real conversation you're really having is often with parts of yourself, and you give them a benefit of the doubt.
One of the things you talk about is money. And you write in the book, quote, our views about money incite feelings that may have nothing to do with how many financial assets we have. Instead, they have everything to do with upbringing, self-perception, and issues related to love, security, independence, power, and control. I mentioned this to my wife, Anne, because I don't like to talk about money at all. I'm not trying to get free therapy. Maybe I am during the podcast.
Okay.
But I'm like, why is that? And it has been a source of contention at different parts of our marriage. She handles the money. She does all the finances. I don't do any of it. I don't like talking about it. I was brought up fairly privileged. I was sort of like, what is it that's going on that makes me want to avoid this conversation at all costs?
Yeah. So money, like sex, is really not about, you know, and you said it perfectly, the actual dollar bills and the actual accumulation or lack thereof of financial assets. It's often what it's attached to. And we live in a capitalistic society. We live in a country and/or related countries where our value is assessed by our worth. And our worth is assessed often by our wealth or the lack of access to resources. Hmm. And so the money from an early stage, just like that other example, starts to have this gravitas and this meaning that is really above and beyond an actual currency. And we learn quickly that money is about what I'm able to do with it, right? Money is about how I'm able to have consistent access to X, Y, and Z, how I'm able to show my allegiance and my gratitude in my faith-based community or in my, you know, small group or in my vacation network or my buddies from college. So it rarely is about paying a bill. Mm-hmm. It rarely is about, you know, giving to the homeless person or to my favorite charity. It's generally about what is it that I identify as a marker for my value. And many of us came up in cultures where you didn't talk about money because the minute you did, you would likely find yourself somewhere on a projected lineup where you either were in the plenty or in the lack, and either community required you to defend yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Why is it that you don't have anything? You're supposed to. Or, oh, you have so much. You can't understand what I'm talking about. So it started to cause a lot of contrivance and challenge our ability to unite and integrate and be with even our neighbor or our family members, because that difference seemed to be almost as palatable as some of our racial or cultural or our gender identity values. And so that's part of why many of us were taught at early ages, and it was the same in my family, you don't talk about what you have. As a matter of fact, make sure everyone thinks you have more than you do, because you get treated differently. You get treated with respect. It's none of their business, you know, even to this day. So I think when you're in touch with that, it allows us to do what you said earlier, to really look underneath of what that value and belief system is about, and make sure when we have our children and we have those that we're responsible for influencing, we invite them to uncover what is it that you feel when you talk about money? What is it that you think? And what do you imagine I think and feel? And so how do we shift that narrative into a different story between us?
So I found there was a really salient moment in the book. You write, quote, both the millionaire executive and the poorly paid restaurant worker can be driven by silent agreements to avoid poverty at all costs. This, to me, is part of the national conversation right now. This is the conversation around why are these companies not paying taxes? You know, this is the conversation around, like, and it kind of makes sense when you look at it this way, which is like, oh, you know, it's a scarcity mindset that even the most wealthy are having. thing. And it seems ridiculous when you sort of step back from it, but we've allowed it to kind of normalize. Is that kind of, am I on the right track there?
You're on the right track. I mean, you said it so eloquently. We don't have enough opportunities to reflect and integrate what the absence of these conversations on the national stage is actually doing in our local homes, right? So we wake up and we are looking at television and we're reading the paper and we're saying, wait a minute, that's not right. And then you turn around and you go, well, wait a minute, that's the same conversation I just had with my sister. You know, that's the same conversation we're having at my church. And there's this way that the only way that we offer, the only way to break through these silent agreements and what they, the strongholds they hold on our mind, and the way that they stop us from being adaptively able to change in these complex environments, is we have to have more conversation. Mm-hmm. And I love improvisation because we don't all talk with words, right? We talk through our bodies, we talk through our eyes, we talk through just being in each other's presence. But when it comes to money, and when it even comes to sex, we need to have the conversation and break the saliency of it so that we can break into the silence of it and start to ask ourselves, how do we shift this conversation into an open understanding where we can level the playing field enough to see where our story started and invite other communities, even in our own, you know, places of work or in our own family Thanksgiving dinners, we can start to say, how do we do it? How do we make a conversation about money that doesn't end up putting us in a scarcity mindset or a abundant mindset or have us hiding our bank account and our receipts?
Yep.
How do we do that?
Yeah. Well, and you said some interesting just now where you talked about understanding where our stories started. I remember talking to Bob Johansson, who's a futurist on the podcast, and he said one of the things that people misunderstand about generations is their differences are really, they only matter when they start, because that's the essential difference. Like, did your generation start having access to the computers? You know, mine didn't. And that is the essential difference. All the other stuff is very connected among human beings. So that is interesting because, and that goes back to, and I want to talk about parenting because I always find when I go out and speak about using improvisation in business and in life, people always want to be like, how do you use it as a parent? And I say, absolutely. But one of the tricks with the silent agreement, right, is that can kind of screw up your parenting skills.
Oh, absolutely. Because you're working out of a blind spot.
Yeah.
You know, this is the challenge. Years and years and years of you passing on generational approaches, using language you didn't even understand. Until I watched Downton Abbey, I didn't understand where half of the colloquialisms that my grandmother, my mother came with. And I was like, oh my God, these things cross the water. I mean, these things are old.
Yeah.
So it's the understanding, and Bob says it perfectly. Where do these things begin? And then what have we taken time to let go of? I'm big on family meetings. As a clinician, I always tell my family therapy groups that what I want you to do is use that family time to unpack stories, to unpack the generations. Two parents can have six children, but each child has a different set of parents because the parents were parenting differently with each child. You know, they grew in experience and then they changed in technology. So their approaches to even the basic ways that they expected their child to learn and to participate in community activities actually changes. So you have six different children around the table. So I love the idea of noticing where the story started and where your parenting starts, because it didn't start with you.
No.
It started with your great-grandmother. And you can say, wait a minute. I'm glad we're thinking about this and doing this reflective time because I don't want to do that anymore. I don't need to have that way of thinking about it because that silences my child or that silences my wife or my partner. And I don't want to look at my life in that way. It takes a level of awareness, that we think is important, then a level of discernment. What did I become aware of? And a level of understanding before you can commit to the action. And we just say, stay with awareness and discernment long enough for that thing to bubble up and you figure out where is the root to this mega silent agreement that keeps leading me to parent in a particular way.
Yeah. And it makes me think of, like, you know, this idea of, like, the way we tell ourselves stories about ourselves that are not true, because we've used them to sort of make sense of something that didn't make sense. And I would imagine that's super true for kids who really don't have the capacity to understand what's going on in front of them. But then that becomes a root. So if you got to sort of ferret that out and, like, okay, why did I do that? Probably because I didn't know or understand what was in front of me. But then that affects the way that you are going to be parenting or relating to other people.
That's it. These self-awareness groups, you know, I bump into identities that I have formed about myself, and I put them on a shelf because they worked well when I was in corporate, you know, or they worked well when I worked in the governor's office. And now that I'm out of those spaces, the language and the way that I relate is still sometimes hung in that rubric. And I have to stop and go, I don't even think that way anymore. Mm-hmm. So to your point, it does mean that in our relationships, our closest relationships where we really, again, have that love and trust and we have that gratitude, we need to do those mirroring exercises. And I ask couples to do them every month. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the month, put the, you know, blanket out in the living room, your favorite foods, put on comfortable clothing, and just start to say, sweetheart, what are you seeing in me? Mm-hmm. You know, what have you noticed about? And people are like, what the heck are you talking about? I said, look, it's a conversation. But if you want to grow up and grow in, you have to decide that you can let go of some of these narratives that just don't fit. It's like wearing the clothes you wore in high school.
Yeah.
Just because they fit doesn't mean you should put them on.
No, no one wants to see me in a members only jacket.
Exactly. We're like, what are you, doesn't fit anymore, you know? So, it matters that we take time to do this reflective integration.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're coming close to the end when I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, you have a really interesting chapter on health. And you write in the book, quote, "We sometimes tell people we're fine when we know we're far from it." That is true in many ways, I imagine, because I don't think you're just talking about a physical injury. I think you're talking about our mental health. It could be our spiritual health. Because, you know, in many ways, especially in the workplace, suffering and pain are taboo, which strikes me as a real problem because they're essential to the human condition.
That's right.
So what are the silent agreements you see people sort of that they're telling themselves with regard to this issue of health?
Yeah, it's exactly what you said. You know, we create almost like a movie in our mind of what people are seeing when they see us. And we become that character. And that's who we show up as. It's our armor. You know, it's the person that we leave in the car and instead take the other identity to work. Because that's the one that sells. That's the one that lets us get this positive reinforcement. But we are literally killing ourselves because that isn't the human condition. And so part of what we say in the book is the way to get through your silent agreements about your health is to start by taking a look at the person that you really, really, really want to be. You know, when you start coaching, everyone says, what do you want? What do you really, really want? And that is the quintessential question, because if you can get to that, and that means you've got to take, you know, a couple of mountain trips, and you may have to do a lot of coaching or counseling, your ability to go into your workplace or your, you know, civic meeting or whatever as the true self, it actually starts to bring you more confidence, you know, which, as we know, is fidelity to the self, right? Yeah. Because, yes, I'm showing up. I'm feeling like I have a headache today, and I'm going to work through it, but I'll probably take a nap for lunch. You're going to expand in your consciousness and relatability. We haven't gotten there as a culture or a country, and I think it's up to people like us to keep asking why and what will it take to be able to make it a safe, psychologically safe, and actually workplace safe environment, so you can trust that the relationships that you have at work are just as human and want to share their real health condition, because we're hiding from ourselves, and that means we're hiding from our best performance.
Yeah, there was an academic we had on in their business book, and they said one of the things that they encourage in meetings, especially like first beginning of the day, is everyone go around and talk about a problem they're having. And it can be like, my big toe is hurting, because just by saying it out loud, they are, you know, opening themselves up to not just obsessing on it, because that's what we do.
That's right. That's right. And you nailed it. Check-in is great. On a scale of 1 to 10, where are you? And what would it take for you to bump up a point or two? Those check-ins are becoming the currency in corporate, and I love it, because it starts to open the door to the silent agreement that we've made with our body and with ourselves about our ability to trust our team to handle our differences. So that's totally a way in. Thank you for saying that.
I think so. Okay, so the way we always end the podcast is we ask our guests for a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere saying no. You can't stop at saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story from your work or your life.
I do, from my work. I was at Richmond, Virginia, assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, directing the training clinics for the graduate students in psychology. And I was enjoying myself and having great fun expanding the space and moving us into other territory with other social science fields. And right in the middle of this amazing growth spurt, where the dean was recognizing I'd moved us into a new building, I was looking at the School of Social Work and School of Nursing and Rehab Counseling, making one common goal as a clinical community center, I was offered an opportunity in my church, which was a huge mega church, to become the chief learning officer over 20,000 people trying to move this organization into a life stage church. So imagine a clinical psychologist who just loves adventure, mm-hmm. noticing a new opportunity to basically build church by your life stage. So a church for the teenagers, for the 20-year-olds, the 30-year-olds, the 40-year-olds, they each had their own pastor, and they could actually understand their spiritual identity through their life stage. And I looked at that. Keep in mind, you know, you've got tenure, you have all kinds of great benefits. And instead of thinking, oh, how about you try that as a consultant and keep your day job, I got so caught up in the possibility and the impact of what I could do that I quit my job at Virginia Commonwealth University that I'd left New York to go to, and I said yes, St. Paul's Baptist Church, and I started this entire new life of looking at what we now look at as like the 3 D's, you know, the development of the psychology, the development of the spiritual self, and the development of the mind for these particular people that are trying to make meaning of their life in a particular way. And I met the guy that changed me, Andy Stanovich, who had the company Play. I was a professor at Play for the weekend. And when I left that, I said yes to Play, and I never looked back at clinical practice the same way. So I've been saying yes for a while. Andy Stanovich changed my life, and St. Paul's changed my life because I said yes, and I would still say yes again.
That's great. The book is called Silent Agreements, How to Free Your Relationships of Unspoken Expectation. Sonia Banks, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Take good care.
Well, I've been working. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to
working.